as to what genuine wisdom really is and where it truly comes from. So Job chapter 28, let's read now the first four verses. There is a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined. Iron is taken from the earth and copper is smelted from ore. Man puts an end to the darkness. He searches the farthest reaches for ore in the blackest darkness. Far from where people dwell, he cuts a shaft in places forgotten by the foot of man. Far from men, he dangles and sways. Job now reflects and he now meditates on the true source of wisdom. And so I want to tell you at this point, his emotions have now cooled off a little bit. His emotions have now somewhat subsided. And he is contemplating. He's just thinking about all of his problems. He's thinking about the existence of man. You ever do that? Have you lived long enough that sometimes you just stop and you think about, why am I here? And what's this all about? And what is the purpose of it all? And Job is just, he's just thinking about his problems. He's thinking about the existence of a man and what life is really all about. So Job explains, he starts off by explaining how men diligently search after precious metals. Now remember, in this day and time, they didn't have all of this mining equipment. They didn't have hydraulics. They didn't have diesel engines. They didn't have all of these things that we have now. And he explains how men would diligently search after precious metals, that they would light up dark places and they would search every crevice and every crack. And he says they dig a shaft. You ever thought about how did they dig a shaft in the earth? How did they bore through solid rock? It was hard, wasn't it? You think about the effort that was involved in that. And Job talks about them personally endangering themselves in the pursuit of these valuable resources, gold and silver and iron and all those things that they were looking for. Job refers to geology and to mining techniques. And really, if you look at this, don't just pass it by. If you look at this, this is really a pretty remarkable piece of the Bible letting us know about man's ingenuity at the time and just what man was able to accomplish. And yet, left to himself, a man left to himself, as we read about in Proverbs, cannot find wisdom. And what Job is saying is that wisdom is that treasure that is more rare than all of the other treasures. It's more precious than gold and silver and iron and rubies and diamonds. Job says it's harder to get to. It's more rare than all the others. So go back to the text now and let's go 5 through 11. The earth from which food comes is transformed below as by fire. Sapphires comes from its rocks, and its dust contains nuggets of gold. No bird of prey knows that hidden path. No falcon's eye has seen it. Proud beasts do not set foot on it, and no lion prowls there. Man's hand assaults the flinty rock and lays bare the roots of the mountains. He tunnels through the rock. His eyes see all of its treasures. He searches the sources of the rivers and brings hidden things to light. Job just keeps on talking about the earth as treasure, as a house filled with valuable riches. And you know, when I read this, I just still think about how did they mine? How did they get through the rock? How did they get deep into the earth? I was building a fence and on the farm, and I hit a certain section where there was a lot of rock in the ground. And I was digging like this. You know what I'm talking about? I'm not talking about with my tractor. I'm talking about with post hole diggers. And I thought, this is not going to conquer me. I'm going to beat this. I'm going to do this. And ultimately, I did. And I pounded and I pounded and I pounded. And I had blisters on my hands. And at one point, I pulled the post hole diggers out of the ground and just looked at them. And the ends that are sharp and are supposed to cut the ground, I had literally just folded them up. I just pounded on that thing until I had folded those ends up. And I think about that, and I think about Job describing how men in his day went down into the earth where there was no light, where animals had not seen where they are, where no lion was able to prowl in this area. And he says they did that because there was valuable treasure. There was gold, there was silver, there was sapphire down in there. And what Job is doing is he is explaining how hard men are willing to work to gain that kind of treasure, to dig out that wealth that is hidden deep down in the earth. When you consider the day and the time in which this is written, and you hear him talk about tunneling and going through rock, you understand just what people went through to mine for treasure. Job's point will be, and we're about to read it, wisdom is even harder to find than that. True godly wisdom is harder to find than that. Now look at 12 through 19. But where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? Man does not comprehend its worth. It cannot be found in the land of the living. The deep that he's been talking about, the deep says, it is not in me. The sea says, it is not in me. It cannot be bought with the finest gold, nor can its price be weighed in silver. It cannot be bought with the gold of Ophir, with precious onyx or sapphires. Neither gold nor crystal can compare with it, nor can it be had for jewels of gold. Coral and jasper are not worthy of mention. The price of wisdom is beyond rubies. The topaz of Cush cannot compare with it. It cannot be bought with pure gold. And as I told you at the outset, I feel like I'm reading Solomon again. I feel like I'm reading the book of Proverbs all over again. Men search hard, Job says, and they are willing to endure danger and risk to their very lives for the sake of the riches that they dig up out of the earth. But all of that, he says, is easy. It's easy when compared to your search for true and godly wisdom. You cannot find it in the deep. It is not located in the sea. Gold won't buy it. Silver won't buy it. No other precious gem compares to it. And Job is reminding these three friends who thought they were so smart, who thought they knew it all, who thought they had the answers to everything. Job is reminding them that true wisdom is rare, rare, rare. Now, I have asked you before, and I'm going to ask you again this morning, have you changed your mind about some things over the course of the years of your life? Now, there are people that you will associate with in your family, people you'll associate with at work, and certainly people you will associate with in the church, that their mind is completely made up. Everything is black or white. There is no gray. There is no middle ground. They will never tell you, I don't know, I'm not sure. Someday we'll know the truth about all of that. There are folks like that. I'm going to tell you, there are things I have changed my mind about biblically, scripturally. A lot of things I've changed my mind about over the years. And Job is reminding his friends, you are not as smart as you might think that you are. True and godly wisdom is very rare. It's hard to find. And so now, he's going to talk about the source and the summary of that wisdom. Go back to the text. Let's read 20 to 28. Where then does wisdom come from? Where does understanding dwell? It is hidden from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds of the air. Destruction and death say, only a rumor of it has reached our ears. God understands the way to it, and He alone. He alone knows where it dwells, for He views the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When He established the force of the wind and measured out the waters, when He made a decree for the rain and a path for the thunderstorm, then He looked at wisdom and appraised it. He confirmed it and tested it. And He said to the man, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding. Boy, doesn't that sound so much like Solomon. Job has explained just how hard it is to find wisdom. And then he asked the logical question in front of his friends. Okay, boys, where does it come from? This wisdom that I'm talking about, this wisdom that is more precious than gold or silver or fine jewels, where does that wisdom come from? And Job knew the answer to his own question. He knew the answer. He knew that God alone was the source of all true wisdom. And so in application, exactly as Solomon taught us in Proverbs, by application, that means that there is only one place that you can look and find genuine, true wisdom, and that is God. That is God. And if a man thinks he has received true wisdom from any other source, he has been fooled. He's been fooled. There is no other source for true and genuine wisdom. Do you think we live in a world where we think we're so smart? I believe we do. We think we are so smart. We are so wise. We've got the answers to everything. And if you just have this certain knowledge, or if you've earned these certain degrees, we believe there is no question out there that we cannot answer. But Job understood what David understood. Job understood what David's son Solomon understood, that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of all wisdom. And how many times when we studied the book of Proverbs did we hear Solomon say, if a man does not believe in God, if a man does not acknowledge God, doesn't matter how smart he thinks he is, doesn't matter how wise he believes he is, Solomon used a particular word over and over and over again in the book of Proverbs. You remember what that word was? Fool. He's a fool. That man is a fool. If true wisdom can be gained by human effort, human energy, and human ingenuity, like those rare and precious metals of the earth, then you don't need the fear of the Lord. The gaining of true wisdom requires the total sacrifice of our single most precious possession, and that's us, ourselves. More specifically, what is required is the surrender of our wills. Do you understand why a lot of people won't obey the gospel? Why a lot of people won't give themselves to God? Because they are not willing to totally and completely surrender their own will. See, we live in a world that says, nobody's going to tell me. What's the rest of that? Right. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. Now, how naive is that? How naive is that? If you've got a job, when you go to your job tomorrow, do you say, well, then nobody here going to tell me what to do. I'm going to do what I want to do. Nobody going to tell me what to do. How long are you going to last in that job? Not long. Not long. And in relationships in life, whether it's a husband and a wife, a parent and a child, that mindset of, well, nobody's going to tell me what to do. I do what I want to do. What's that going to get you? It's going to bring disaster. It's going to bring heartache. Yes, sir. That's exactly right. Yep. And that's sad, isn't it? That's a sad statement to have to make, but we're not. And see, we live, as particularly Americans, we live in a culture where we pride ourselves on nobody's going to tell me what to do. Nobody's going to make a choice for me. And listen to it in our political and cultural discussion. It's a woman's right to choose. It's a person's right to choose who they love. And we just on and on and on we go with, I am the captain of my own ship. I'm in control of my own destiny. And if you believe that, you are naive. You are naive. I am my own God. That's a good way to put it. It's a very good way to put it. I am my own God. And nobody, not even God the Father, is going to tell me what to do. Let me ask you, when you open your Bible up and you look in there, are there some things in that Bible that you wish weren't in there? I can tell you there's some things in there that I wish were not in there. You know what they are? All the stuff I'm guilty of. Are you with me? You understand? You say, boy, I wish that wasn't in there. Why? Because that indicts me. And the surrender, the complete surrender of our will to the will of God. That's what Job is driving at about true and godly wisdom. Well, his speech continues now in chapter 29. Let's read verses 1 through 6. And Job's going to do a little reminiscing. He's going to do a little reflecting, a little remembering of some better days. Job continued his discourse. How I long for the months gone by. For the days when God watched over me, when His lamp shone upon my head, and by His light I walked through the darkness. Oh, for the days when I was in my prime. Any of y'all ever say that? Oh, I've spent the last 4 days crawling around on my hands and knees, putting out pine straw under all the landscaping. Oh, about 120 bales is what it took to do at the house and all the buildings and all that. On my hands and knees, on my hands and knees. And as I've got up, I've sounded like Joe. Oh, for the days when I was in my prime. I didn't like it then. I really don't like it now. Oh, for the days when God's intimate friendship blessed my house. Don't miss that part. When the Almighty was still with me and my children were around me. When my path was drenched with cream and the rock poured out for me streams of olive oil. You ever do that? You ever do a little reminiscing? Thinking back to when you were younger and when you were stronger and when you didn't ache and hurt like you do now. Job longed not only for the days before he lost his children and he lost his health and he lost his wealth. What I want you to notice here is that he especially longed for the days before he lost his sense of closeness with God. He says it himself. Look at it there in your text. There was a time when God watched over me. There was a time when I had intimate friendship with God. And He was there for me. And I knew He was looking after me. And He was caring for me. And Job is saying, those days are long gone. His keenest sorrow is revealed. It was the feeling that in some way, and for whatever reason that he cannot explain, God no longer watches over him. He no longer has that intimate friendship with God. Job fondly remembered the days when it seemed like God was for him. Everything he did, God was for him and not against him. And he just paints a beautiful picture of what life used to be like and how happy it really was. But please don't miss the fact that it was because he genuinely felt he was in fellowship with God and that God's blessings overflowed on every part of his life. He doesn't say it was because my bank account was fatter than it is now, or my children were here and now they're not, or my wife was happy and now she's not, or I was strong and vibrant and now I'm not. It's all about his relationship, that lost relationship that he feels with God. Now 7 through 17. When I went to the gate of the city and took my seat in the public square, the young men saw me and they stepped aside. And the old men rose to their feet. The chief men refrained from speaking and covered their mouths with their hands. The voices of the nobles were hushed and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouths. Whoever heard me spoke well of me, and those who saw me commended me because I rescued the poor who cried for help and the fatherless who had none to assist him. The man who was dying blessed me. I made his widow's heart sing. I put on righteousness as my clothing. Justice was my robe and my turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy. I took up the case of the stranger. I broke the fangs of the wicked and snatched the victims from their teeth. That's exactly the opposite of what his friends accused him of, don't you think? And Job was blessed in his relationships with people. Notice how he just reflects on how greatly respected he was in the community. He had a position of community leadership. He was feared by the young men. He was honored by the old men. even princes and nobles, they just stopped talking whenever Job started talking. They stopped. And they said, you know what? We need to listen to this man. This man's got something to say. It's important. It matters. And they listened to him. But it was more than that. It was more than just respect and people listening to Job. I want you to understand, people liked him. People liked Job. He was a man full of good works, especially to the poor and the disadvantaged. And even though he was a man who had a lot of wealth, great wealth and influence, he used that wealth. And he used that influence to do good things. He was not greedy and selfish. He didn't just amass everything for himself. He put it to work. He took what God put in his hands and he put it in the hands of other people so that he might be a blessing to them. Job believed that sin meant more than just doing something wrong. He believed it also included not doing good when you had the opportunity to do good. He believed it would be sinful in his life for God to have given him so much and blessed him with so much and not to share that with other people. Do you realize that not one single time until now, in this entire book, where are we now? Chapter 29? Not one single time in this entire book until now has Job talked about his own good deeds. He has made his stand on his faith and not on his deeds. And the fact that Job waited so long, this long, in the midst of all these accusations and all of these discussions, to introduce any hard evidence into this debate with his friends about whether he was a good man or an evil man, about whether he was hiding some sin that he just wouldn't confess, I think shows enormous restraint on the part of Job. Now let's read 18 through 20. I thought, I will die in my own house. My days, as numerous as the grains of sand. My roots will reach to the water, and the dew will lie all night on my branches. My glory will remain fresh in me, the bow ever new in my hand. You see what he's saying? Job says, let me tell you. I thought that I would die secure. I thought I'd die a happy man after a good long life. I don't think that anymore. I don't believe that any longer. And he used to be so blessed and he had such abundance that he had his life all planned out. He could see the end. In his mind, he knew how all this was going to work out, but not anymore. It's all gone now. 21 to 25. Men listen to me expectantly, waiting in silence for my counsel. After I had spoken, they spoke no more. My words fell gently on their ears. They waited for me as for showers and drank in my words as the spring rains. When I smiled at them, they scarcely believed it. The light of my face was precious to them. I chose the way for them and sat as their chief. I dwelt as a king among his troops. I was like one who comforts mourners. You think this man was respected? He was greatly respected and esteemed in his community. And he was a man that whenever he started talking, everybody just stopped. And they listened. They wanted to hear his wise words. He was a chief among men, a leader among people. And those people were very happy to have his attention. If he just smiled at them, they felt like they were blessed. Job was a tremendous example of how a wealthy and powerful man is supposed to live his life. He did not live in selfish indulgence, but rather he lived in care and concern for people who were not as fortunate as he was. Job had it on straight. He was doing it right. But chapter 30 brings lament. He talks about the good old days and how everything used to be and how good it used to be. Chapter 30 brings his lament. Let's read verses 1 through 8. But now they mock me. Men younger than I, whose fathers I would have disdained to put with my sheepdogs. Of what use was the strength of their hands to me since their vigor had gone from them? Haggard from want and hunger, they roamed the parched land and desolate wastelands at night. In the brush they gathered salt herbs, and their food was the root of the broom tree. They were banished from their fellow men, shouted at as if they were thieves. They were forced to live in the dry stream beds, among the rocks and in holes in the ground. They brayed among the bushes and huddled in the underbrush. A base and nameless brood, they were driven out of the land. Job is tortured. He is absolutely tortured by the irony of where his life now is. Think about what he's just told you about how honored and respected he was. The sons of men whom Job would not have allowed to have even gone out with his dogs that guarded his flocks, they were now his mockers. They were now his critics. They were the ones who pointed at him and laughed and snickered and whispered and made fun of him. And he just thinks about all the worthless men who are now his very loud critics. And how unjust, how unfair the whole thing has turned out to be. And the lengthy description of these good-for-nothing fathers is a special brand of rhetoric that he uses. He wants to define for you, the reader, just how base and vile these people were. He's not doing it to try and build himself up, but he wants to heighten the pathetic nature of his own dishonor. He wants you to feel how dishonored he now is, how pathetic his life has become. And now he's going to describe just how they mocked him. Go back to the text. Let's read 9 through 15. And now their sons mock me in song. Can you imagine? I have become a byword among them. They detest me and keep their distance. They do not hesitate to spit in my face. Now that God has unstrung my bow and afflicted me, they throw off restraint in my presence. On my right, the tribe attacks. They lay snares for my feet. They build their siege ramps against me. They break up my road. They succeed in destroying me without anyone's helping them. They advance as through a gaping breach. Amid the ruins, they come rolling in. Terrors overwhelm me. My dignity is driven away as by the wind. My safety vanishes like a cloud. Do you understand what this means? If you don't, I want to be very clear with you at this point in Job's life. Let me tell you, Job did not sneak out of town when everything hit. When all of this calamity happened, he didn't sneak out of town. Do you understand? He was run out of town. We would say he was run out on a rail. That's where you find him. Remember? Remember from the beginning portions of the book? Where do you find him? Sitting on an ash heap at the city dump, which was always well outside of town. And what's he doing? He is scraping himself with a broken piece of pottery because of all of these festering boils and scabs that cover him from the crown of his head to the soles of his feet. And that would mean that his neighbors, you know what they did? They forcibly removed him. He was publicly humiliated. You ever heard that old saying? If you hear you're about to get run out of town, hurry and get up front and make it look like a parade. That'd be some good advice, wouldn't it? Well, Job didn't have the opportunity to hurry and get up front and make it look like a parade. He was run out of town. His neighbors forcibly removed him, publicly humiliated him. And if you look, verse 14 is very vivid, quite vivid, as Job describes himself like a city. He says, I'm a city that has this wide gaping hole in the wall. And everything he had previously enjoyed is now vanished like a cloud. I got to tell you, folks, I feel so sorry for this guy. I feel pity for him. And listen to his, now he's going to talk about his current life. Listen to his present misery and pain. Look at 16 through 23. And now, let me tell you what's happening to me now. My very life ebbs away. Days of suffering grip me. Night pierces my bones. My gnawing pains never rest. In his great power, God becomes like clothing to me. He binds me like the neck of my garment. He throws me into the mud, and I am reduced to dust and ashes. I cry out to you, O God, but you do not answer. I stand up, but you merely look at me. You turn on me ruthlessly. With the might of your hand, you attack me. You snatch me up and drive me before the wind. You toss me about in the storm. I know you will bring me down to death, to the place appointed for all the living. You got the picture? That's a pretty bad situation. Job says, God has grabbed me by the scruff of my neck. God's grabbed me by the collar of my coat. And you know what he does with me when he grabs me by the neck? When he grabs me by my collar? What does Job say God does with him? He throws me in the mud. Job describes the sheer pain of his disease as if it were some kind of terrifying monster. And I'm sure in his mind it was, just chewing at his flesh day and night. I cry out to you, God, where are you? You're not listening to me. That was the worst part of it all. In Job's heart and in his mind, God wasn't there anymore. For whatever reason, God had turned his back on him. He undeniably felt that God had forsaken him. Now think about this for a moment. Think about this. What was Jesus' greatest struggle at the cross? Was it the physical pain that he was enduring? Was it going through with what he willingly came to the earth to go through? I don't think so. I think his greatest struggle at the cross is, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why have you turned your back on me? And Job felt God undeniably was against him, that God had forsaken him. And more than that, Job believed that God wanted to and ultimately would destroy him after he decided Job had suffered enough. But right now, God hadn't decided that. God's constant attack and his ruthless might was so completely opposite to that intimate friendship that Job believed he had had with God all of those bygone days. He couldn't understand it. Couldn't wrap his mind around it. I don't think I could. Job believed that very soon he would die. He had no illusions about that. But he also believed in the meantime, God was just going to continue to crush him until there was absolutely nothing left to crush. Isn't that sad? So let's read 24 to the end of this chapter. Surely no one lays a hand on a broken man when he cries for help in his distress. Have I not wept for those in trouble? Has not my soul grieved for the poor? Yet when I hoped for good, evil came. When I looked for light, then came darkness. The churning inside of me never stops. Days of suffering confront me. I go about blackened, but not by the sun. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. I have become a brother of jackals, a companion of owls. My skin grows black and peels. My body burns with fever. My harp is tuned to mourning and my flute to the sound of wailing. Job's saying, God, you are more merciful than this. God, I know you. I know your character. I know your heart. And I don't understand, because I know you are more merciful than this. You would not afflict a pitiful heap of ruin like I am. Why will you not respond to my cries? And you see, the supreme sorrow in Job's heart was that when he cried out to God, he wasn't hearing an answer. He was not seeing the evidence of God. And he claimed that in such suffering as he has endured, he claimed in front of these three friends who said, you just need to quit whining. You need to quit complaining. You need to confess whatever this sin is that you're keeping secret, that God knows and you know, but you won't confess it to the rest of us. Job believed that there was ample justification for his complaint. But you see, Job misinterprets God's silence as a lack of concern. He misinterprets the fact that he's not getting an answer from God as God's indifference. Job assumes that God's silence means God's displeasure. And we know that it does not. And Job will find out that it does not. But Job wonders why God does not treat him with the same kindness that Job has so often shown to other people in his own life. And friends, it is impossible to read this section without feeling that protest was approaching absolute revolt in the soul of this man. And I'm not going to criticize him one second. I'm not going to say, oh, Job was, you know, Job, I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have said that. I wouldn't have thought that. Not for one second. The very sensitive soul of Job was just yet another demonstration of his godliness and his blameless nature. But his heart is in turmoil. Everything he's ever known has been turned completely upside down. And for him, there is no rest. Did you notice as he talked about his physical condition, what does he say happened to his skin? What color did it turn? It turned black. Can you imagine? His skin turned black, and then what happened? It's just peeling. It was just peeling off. And he says that he burned up with a constant fever. I mean, this guy is in great physical agony. He is in great spiritual agony, and it was more than it seemed he could bear. And it was certainly more than his friends or anybody who surrounded him, mocked him, made fun of him, spit on him, could ever even relate to. There was no relief, none. Job says himself, the churning never stops, and you just feel great emotion as you listen to his cries to God. Well, I think this is a good stopping place. But before you close your Bible, just take a peek at chapter 31. Next time, when we come to chapter 31, Job is going to complete this final rebuttal, this final defense. And I want to encourage you to go ahead and read ahead so you'll be ready to resume our discussion next week. And you think, okay, finally, all of the speeches are now done. Endless speeches. Sort of reminds you of all these politicians, doesn't it? But there's one more guy. There's a fourth guy who's going to come onto the scene, and he's going to say, Job, you got it all wrong. And you three friends who all think you're so smart, you got it all wrong. I know you're all older than me, and you should be more seasoned and experienced and knowledgeable than me, but you all four of you now need to listen. I'm going to straighten all of you out. I'm going to set the whole thing straight. So be reading ahead, and thank you for being in our class this morning.